button, press the button. This is not working. Yours is says charging and it's not doing anything. Yes, we're working now. Thank you. All right, ladies, we're on sheet 55. Again, my apologies that much of today's sheet is in the vernacular English, but it just means that my slightly croaky throat can get a rest and you can read some of it. I'm not going to read every single source. It's good for your English to read English which is written in on a higher standard than what most people normally read. Rav Soloveitchik's English is very good, say it's his fourth language, and Rav Aaron's English is superlative. In every sense, and you should therefore read a lot of Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. I've been giving this shift for a number of years, and it's particularly apposite since he passed away so recently. The entire Tradition magazine, this particular, which is produced by the RCA, the Rabbinical Council of America, very, very good, you can get it online free, very good publication. This particular, installment, edition, that's it, has been dedicated to the writings of Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, excuse me, and you should read it. It's very, very interesting. Mostly about Rav Aaron's Torah rather than quoting it, but it obviously brings in a lot of things as well. Now, today we're really dealing with a fascinating topic. Is halacha objective or subjective? Now, of course, it doesn't have to be an extreme. There's going to be a continuum between the two, but let's say how objective and how subjective is it? I brought you at the beginning this very extreme-sounding Rav Soloveitchik piece that got some of you a bit excited. And I, once I'd analyzed it with you, we'll see afterwards that Rav Aaron says it's not as simple as what Rav Soloveitchik says, and Rav Soloveitchik's position was much more nuanced than you might originally think just from reading this alone. And also Rav Soloveitchik himself at the end, on the last piece, is going to give a much more detailed account of this. You can't just take a few lines out of context and then make a whole philosophy based on it. So it starts from a position in the Gemara where it says, Tav lemeitiv tandu milemeitiv aramalu. So a woman would rather be tandu. Dr. Schick informed me that this was a very exciting loan word from Middle Persian, tandu, and we had a very erudite sounding conversation in the Bet Midrash, which involved her saying intelligent things and me just sort of nodding as though I understood what she was saying, which is often the way it seems to go. She told me that tandu means two bodies, two people. So a woman in Persian, a woman would rather be in a twosome, married, than single. The Gemara uses this as a halachi principle in the issue of something like mekachtaut, mekachtos, meaning if you go and enter into some kind of a contractual arrangement and it turns out that it was all a big mistake and it didn't turn out the way that you expected it to, generally speaking, in halacha you can claim mekachtaut, it's a taut, it's a mistake, and that's not what I wanted, and let's just unravel it and we'll start again. If you go to the shops to buy a washing machine and the electrical place delivers a dishwasher, you don't say, oh, okay, you know, I'll use it. It's fine. You call them up and you say, hello, this is the wrong machine. Please get someone to bring it, take it back, and bring me the right thing next week. You know, you don't settle for those. Make up toss. So too, in theory, if you got married to a guy, and the guy turned out to be very disappointing on all sorts of levels, you thought he was going to be motivated and talented and this and that, turns out to be a layabout, good for nothing, useless, you know, guy, and you said, look, this is absolutely not what I thought and I was told, etc. I want to unravel the marriage and start again. I don't need a divorce. I don't need a get. Because the whole thing is was never a kiddushin. It's all null from the start. Says the Gemara, you can't really do that. Why? Because tav lemeitiv tandu milemeitiv aramalu. Okay, she doesn't have to sit in this marriage forever. She can get divorced and they can move forward from there. But she can't turn around and say there's no marriage. Why? Because there's a principle in halacha that at the end of the day, a woman would prefer to be married even to a less desirable guy than to be not married at all. Now, the question is, why? Is this true on an objective level? Is this a subjective statement? There are limits. For example, if she marries a guy, it turns out to be a different guy. You know, a sort of Reuben, a Leah Rochel, but the other way around. She goes out with the guy, and it turns out she then married his twin, his identical twin, and she finds out after the wedding. We do not say that she's married. She clearly, there's no marriage. She married someone who turned out to be someone completely different. And there are other reasons why we would also say that, but generally speaking, we don't say that. So Rav Soloveitchik comes along, he says the following. You're going to turn around and say, well, the reality in 4th century Babylonian society was that women were, they had no independent income, they had no independent lives, they were completely subject to the whims of men around them, and if they didn't have a husband, then life was almost unlivable. You had to have some kind of a husband in order to even survive. I'm sure it's true. But today, of course, that's not true. Women have independent income, they have independent lives, they can live, may not happily, I'm not talking about happily, but they can live an entirely a life that actually works on many different levels without getting married ever. And many women do. Some by choice, some by necessity. Fine. So, does this halakha apply today? And Rav Soloveitchik says, absolutely. Look at number two. He says, this has absolutely nothing to do with the social and political status of women in antiquity. The chazakah is not based on sociological factors, but on the verse in Bereishis, and your desire will be to your husband. Meaning, Chazal didn't create this because they looked around them and said, oh, well, women are very open to abuse on different levels. And by the way, that has not changed in many societies, and that has only changed very recently in Western society. One of the things you have to be able to do is get out of that social construct in which you grew up and realize that the big bad world out there is not the way that you necessarily perceive it. Even in your own backyard, things aren't what you think they are. And certainly they weren't always that way. But he says, this is coming from a verse in Bereishis. This is coming from a Torah principle, not from looking around and seeing what was the case. It is not a psychological fact. It is an existential fact. Now, the rabbi is going to state this quite strongly, and not everybody agrees with this position, by the way. This is Rav Soloveitchik's very, halachic man position. You've read Halachic Man. If you haven't read Halachic Man, you must read Halachic Man. This is it's a much, obviously, longer and more detailed exposition than what we have here in front of us. But the Rav's principle of halacha is that it exists as a reality, as an existential reality. It doesn't stem from, we look around the world and we say, the world needs this, we need this, we need that, therefore let's create systems that help us to fit in the world. The hefek, on the contrary, the halachic system exists independently, and the world fits around that. He says the halachic man looks at the sunrise, and rather than just seeing a beautiful image of a large glowing orb sinking in the west, he sees in front of him a matrix of Shkia and Rabbeinu Tam, and like he's literally like the Matrix, where he's seeing these green things up and down. So he's seeing like Shukanos and Tazis and Shaks in front of him, and that translates into a golden orb in the sky. Okay, so the Rav to say that Tav Lemetiv Tandu Lemetiv Armalu is due to inferior social, political or social status of women at the time is simply misunderstanding the Chazakah. The Chazakah is in the principle, the assumption. Not only the Halachot, but all the Chazakot of our sages are indestructible, he says. You must not tamper, not only with the Halachot, but even with the Chazakot. For the Chazakot spoke not upon transient psychological behavioral patterns, but on permanent ontological principles. What does ontological mean? You need to know about six words that you don't normally use in order to learn Soloveitchik. Just learn them and remember them. Existential is easy. That comes from the word existence, which you use in normal life. Okay, existential is in the nature of existence. Okay, what does ontological mean? Related to the nature of being. Of being. Okay, what is being? That's ontology. Okay, what is teleology?
Telos is far away, remote.
Telos is purpose. Function. Is there a purpose? Is there a goal, if you like, for this purpose? And you just have to learn these words. They're not that hard. You learned all sorts of long words when you were at high school. Just learn another bunch of long words and you'll be able to understand Rav Soloveitchik. Halachic man is actually not a particularly difficult word. Halachic mind is much more difficult. It needs a lot of philosophical background to really get the most out of it. But halachic man, just learn these words, not hard. See, this is an ontological principle, one second, meaning it goes to the nature of the existence of man, mankind, rooted in the very depth of the metaphysical human personality. Metaphysical, what does metaphysical mean?
Spiritual.
It goes beyond, we sometimes call it spiritual, beyond the physical existence, meaning there's something metaphysical about sublimated tandu, which is as changeless as the heavens above. Now, what is Rav Soloveitchik saying? You can never change halacha. He's not saying that. And later on we'll see in detail, he says very clearly there's such a thing as chiddush, and halacha changes, develops, innovation, new things, very much into that. But there are certain things, he says, which are fixed, existential, ontological realities, and it's coming in a certain way out of this Kabbalistic idea. Don't forget, the Rav is coming from the Briskas, and the Briskas are coming from Litvisha Kabbalah, which is the Kabbalah of the Gaon, and before that the Kabbalah, you know, going back to the Ariza and the Zohar. Looking number four, very famous Zohar, Kutshu Brichu Istaka Be'araisu Ubara Alma. We had this right at the beginning of the year. HaKadosh Baruch Hu looked into the Torah and created the world. Barnash, so mankind, Mistaka Ba, can now look into Be'araisu, into the Torah, Umakayim Alma, and sustain the world. Meaning, which comes first? The Torah is the pre-existing existential reality, and the physical world is a consequence of that. Again, this is a Kabbalistic idea, so he's saying don't just put Torah into a social, psychological construct and say, now, since that has changed, then the Torah of the Halacha must change as well. Yes, Natalia.
What's the difference between existential and ontological?
Oh, I knew someone was going to ask me difficult questions.
What's the difference between
existing and being? I think ontological is a more abstract, I may be wrong, ontological is a more abstract understanding of the nature of the concept of existence, okay, and what it means of being, okay, what is the nature of that being, as opposed to existential, which is talking specifically about your continued existence and what keeps it going. I think
personal versus more general.
I don't know about the general. I think ontological is more abstract, but I'm not 100% sure. Let's sit down over lunchtime with a dictionary and a Google page and work it out. Okay, fine. Look at number three. Someone read number three. Someone who wants to read a piece of nice, complicated Rav Soloveitchik. Yes, Esther?
Sure.
Why not?
Objectification, we should the highest expression in the
What is objectification? Right. The opposite of subjectification, meaning creating untouchable, objective realities which are not dependent on individual circumstances. Carry on. Seizing the subjective flow, meaning our life is a subjective flow, very much the way that we see things. Okay? Now, I mean, obviously different circumstances will have different objective halachas, but we see things in certain ways. But we need to convert that into something we can grab hold of. It's a beautiful idea, the subjective flow, meaning everything's kind of passing us by, and it's very hard to, you know, you have these moments where, you know, kind of you wonder what's real. I don't mean when you're, you know, half asleep or half awake, but or when you're in some kind of chemically induced state, whatever. But I mean, like, you know,
it's natural.
Yeah, it's natural. Like, you know, so he says at some point we need to kind of grab onto something and say, this is real, and everything has to work around it. Carry on. Which I think speaks for itself. Your individual experience has to turn into something which is more universal. Now, this next sentence I'm going to read. In short, halacha is the objectifying instrument of our religious consciousness. Consciousness being awareness. It is the thing that creates some objective standards in our religious life. The form principle of the transcendental act, meaning we do things which are metaphysical, transcendental, go beyond just the here and now. But we need to turn those, rather than individual, unrelated acts, into some kind of system. The matrix in which the amorphous religious healer is cast. What is helo or heli? This actually is an important term. Mozart strikes again. So, sorry about that. What is heli? And it sounds like a nice girl's name, right? Healing.
I know someone called
Healy. I bet you do.
Kathy and
Healy. I actually know them as well. Okay, Healy, the helo is the Greek understanding of the amorphous, kind of non-physical, but the sort of semi-physical mass which God used to create the physical world. It is not necessarily coming out of the Bracious Yesh Me'ayin, but it's coming out of a Platonic view of what creation was. That God took a non physical semi-matter and turn that into matter. Therefore, just as the Greeks would say, this shtender was ultimately created from this insubstantial heli, so too halacha is what defines the reality of that. Now, the Rav takes a very extreme objective position to halacha, that there is an extreme, there is an objective principle which everything else has to fit around. The question is, how does this work in practice? And this is what I want to look at for the rest of the shiur. You know, to what extent is a posek detached or connected with the context of the times? Do you think it makes a better posek that they know more or they know less about how the world works?
More.
Do you think there is an idea that if a posek can be somehow detached from the subjective attitudes of the world, that makes them more qualified or less qualified?
Rav Moshe, they say about Rav Moshe that he never read a secular book in his life, and that was what enabled him to come up with such amazing kiddushim, because he was not at all influenced by any secular idea whatsoever.
So first of all, they say all sorts of things about Rav Moshe, and not all of them are true. I'm not denying that one or agreeing to it, but does that make sense to you?
You have to understand what stuff you're giving if you don't know the context of what you're giving it.
Right. Do you have how much you need to know where people's minds are coming from in order to give a stack that actually works for them?
Is the Rav actually saying, like, I don't feel like he's saying halacha is definitely objective, but he's not saying to not, or like...
Correct. I don't think he's saying that at all. But there are people who do say that, and there are people who say exactly what Joy just said, that the best poskim of all are the ones who are least connected. The whole concept of Das Torah, which I mean you may have come across in very much in the Haredi world, but also across the Hashkafic perspectives. Das Torah, based on the fact that there are people out there who have a Das, who have a brain which works entirely or almost entirely in Torah, whereas your brain and my brain are sort of contaminated by all the bad movies and all the bad novels and all the secular experiences. Their brains are not contaminated. That makes them more able, better able to actually give a halachic of judgment. Or does it? So the people who know the world that we live in the very least are the best placed people to actually make the judgment as to how to...
Because they have the most pure view of halacha, and so therefore they know what is most...
Good, so we'll talk about that. So
halachically acceptable. So
what we're going to see now is we're going to see how that works in principle. Because Rav Aaron is going to take this and say, the following. Don't get psak and psika mixed up. And we're going to, from now on, have to split these two up. In the world of psak, which is coming to this halachic objectification, then the Rav statement before is going to be more relevant. But in the world of psika, which is taking that theory and turning it into a real psak for Sarah right here, who has Shaila, okay, that's going to be a whole different thing. So let's go through this quite quickly. We're going to have to read... Let's put it together now. Look at number five. We're going to read these. I'm going to read some of these quickly. You're going to read some of these. Let's start with number five. Hurrah. What's hurrah? Ruling, good. It's comprised of two elements, says Rav Aaron. Psak and psika. The former relates to codification, the formulation of the law, pertinent to a given area. It is most characteristically manifested in the adoption on textual or logical grounds of one position in preference to another's. We look at the halachic process, we look at the text, we analyze it, we think about it, we say this there's a kasha on this and there's a series of that, etc. And we come up with a psak. This is how the halacha is finally decided. As such, it is essentially the concluding phrase of the learning process. It's a process in the Bet Midrash, whereas on a grand or narrow scale, and it's locus. What does locus mean? It's the place where it most properly takes place is in the Bet Midrash, over the page. Zika, by contrast, denominates implementation. Meaning, it's not the theory of how the halacha works, but it's the actual practical application of how it will relate to Elisheva's life. It bespeaks the application of what has already been forged in the crucible of the learning experience. What's a crucible? What's that?
A fire.
It's actually not the fire, it's the pot the pot, the iron pot is the crucible in which you melt the gold, etc. It's been forged in the crucible of the learning experience. It applies that to the particular situation. It does not entail the definitive postulation of the law governing a delimited area or its detail, meaning I'm not trying to actually say this is the theoretical halacha in these circumstances, but rather the concurrent, what does concurrent mean? At the same time, means these processes happening at the same time, and coordinate meshing of all aspects possibly drawn from widely divergent spheres. And this is where we get into things outside the halachic system, obtaining in a concrete situation. Meaning, if Elisheva asked me a question, in order to give if I were a posek, which I am not, I would not just have to know the psak, which I would learn in the Midrash, but I'd have to understand the context of Elisheva's life, all the different areas, the divergent spheres, which obtain, what does obtain here mean?
Pertain to,
excellent. In a concrete situation. Its venue is publicly the Beit Din, meaning where does this happen? It happens in the Beit Din, or privately, the meeting of the inquirer and respondent, meaning a shaila and a hurrah is not just something you can get out of a book. It's something that you need to get as a product of a meeting of two human beings. Because I need to understand you, and you need to understand where I'm coming from to work out whether the psak applies and the psika applies. It does not necessarily demand of the posek that he takes a stand or break fresh ground. I don't have to be some machadesh which says things that no one else has said before. But its challenge lies in the need to harness knowledge and responsibility at the interface of reality and halacha. I have a responsibility to you as someone who asked Shaila to understand fully the subjective conditions of your situation, and with that to apply the objective nature of the halacha that the Rav was talking about before.
So there's not the same as the Jew on the island.
Correct. And therefore?
And it just seems like...
You're asking psak or psika?
And it just seems like a flaw, that you can't be a Jew on an island, even if you have every halacha book. If you have the Shulchan Aruch and the Mishnah Berurah, and you're on an island, you still can't be
correct.
A proper Jew.
So are you asking that as a problem, or are you asking...
Yeah, it just seems...
No, but that's the whole point. Halacha... That's why oral law, this is the whole year we've talked about this, that's why oral law ultimately has to be oral. Because if you think about it, when oral law was oral, there had to be a meeting of individuals for it to have to apply. The whole point is books are not ideal, because books depersonalize that halakhic process, which takes away the psika and leaves you with the psak only. That's why even books often say, ask a rabbi. If this happens, ask a rabbi. That happens, ask a rabbi. So what's the point of the book? The answer is that you need books, otherwise, you know, you won't get anywhere. Let's go on. Who's reading number six? Yes, Annie, please. Nice and loud, please.
The cogency and the unity of a human approach to stuff appears to many problematic.
Meaning there are lots of people in this world that feel that human is like not what rabbis should be. Poskim should be, rather. It's not what they're doing. Carry on.
They would have us believe that the ideal prophet is a based on the heart of the soup giver, into whom all of the relevant data fit, and who then produces the right answer. Should this standard not be met, the shortfall is regarded as a failing.
People often ask me, you know, with kind of worried faces, aren't rabbis subjective? Usually when talking about the Chazal, you know, I don't trust subjectivity. I want there to be an objective process. I want it to be like almost like science, as if scientists were not subjective. Which is another thing, because scientific data can often be read in the way that scientists want to read it. Okay, that's not in every situation. But people often want rabbis to be almost like machines. I want to know what God tells me in the expectation that that's going to be some kind of a supercomputer process. Carry on, please.
Honest reading, the process of psika, properly conceived and executed, bears no semblance to an existential encounter between psika and respondent. It entails, rather, the application of text to problems, the coupling of code and situation. This conception does not necessarily preclude reckoning with the specific circumstances of the question and questioner.
Meaning, he's not saying that people think there should be one answer for everybody. Of course, every individual circumstance on a psak level can make a difference to the psak. Everyone knows that. So that's not the issue. Everyone agrees that there are 1,000 different scenarios which have 1,000 different psak halachas. Clear. But the question is, even once you've got to that psak, how does it apply to Natalia specifically? How does it really relate to you, given you're the person asking the shaila? Carry on. The meshiv, meaning the person giving the answer.
That would be obviated entirely by the
What does obviated mean? Obviated? I'm here to teach you English as well. No. What's obviated mean? Come on, Elisheva. You know what obviated means. They must use it in Manchester all the time. It means removed. Okay? That will be removed entirely. Do try and use these words in English at some stage in the next week and a half. Well, depends who you talk to, doesn't it? Okay, fine.
Did you obviate the cat?
No, 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 no. Yeah, you're right, you're right. You can't sound like you just walked out of a, you know, out of a book. You know, my daughter said a very funny thing, because I don't speak very good Hebrew. I speak okay Hebrew, but I come out with things that are grammatically and theoretically 100% correct, but which sound absolutely ridiculous in modern Hebrew. And my kids get very frustrated with me. My daughter came up to me this Shabbos. I've got a book at home saying to her, Mastering Biblical Grammar or something like that. She goes, she said, Abba, should you see this book? Yeah? So she asked, so I said, yes. She goes, learn everything in this book and do completely the opposite. Which is not entirely helpful. But basically, it's like, you know, you can't walk around saying, oh, you know, the Shire's Council, oh, this obviates the need for me to come to school. You know, but that would be quite correct. But you can't talk like that. So, but at least you have to know what it means. So let's get back in. Let's not get sidetracked by the English. Rabbi Aaron was certainly not wanted to be doing that. So, let's carry on, please, Annie.
He, for his part, is to be animated by the precept that we do not have mercy in judgment, and hence pass on the merits of the issue with imperviously sturdy objectivity.
This is how people think a person should be. Well, we don't have mercy in judgment, this is the psak, this is how it is, you don't mess with the halakha, misina, etc. Carry on.
Purist proponents of this approach often cry out as the frum view of
speech. Oh, the frummer you are, the less you smile. Everyone knows that, don't they? So let people have this very frum face. Okay? Carry on, please.
In reality, however, this portrait of a pontic is a mere caricature.
Limbed, no, I didn't know that word either. Limbed means kind of painted.
Limbed by those who at most Karuv v'shanu, but certainly washed.
Now, this is important. Karuv v'shanu v'leishinshu. What does Karuv v'shanu mean? What does Karu mean, correct? What does Karu mean? They read what? What is Kra? Mikra? Torah? Shanu? What is Mishnah? Meaning they learned Torah. They learned Torah Shabbat and Torah Shabbat. But like Shimshu, what does Shimshu mean? What does Shimshu mean? Shimshu
like
on the job, learning how halacha really works in a human way. Many of my poskim told me that it was their Shimush with people that really created the reality of their halachic understanding. One of my close rabbis who sat with Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach for weeks in his study, you know, he drove him in his car, he saw how he spoke to people, how he interacted with people, how real shilas were dealt with in a real human way. That's how halacha works. Therefore, people who think of halacha as a totally objective process and ignore the psika angle, says they karu v'shanu v'lo shimshu. And there's a lot of people around, by the way, who karu v'shanu v'lo shimshu. They have a lot of book knowledge, but they never sat with real poskim and learned the art of how to be a posek. Carry on.
As anyone who's been privileged to observe Solomon Kosan can readily attest, they approach the sock doubly animated by responsibility to halacha. The balance between norm and need may be variously struck. There certainly are ideological differences among poskim over how much weight to assign the human factor. In principle, however, recognition of this factor is a rule rather than
exception. Right, meaning, bottom line, almost everybody agrees, and well, everyone needs to some degree or other, that a human factor is essential in psika. Psak is an objective process that happens in a vacuum, in a bet midrash. Psika is a very specific application to the circumstances at hand. Now, have a look, please. Now, maybe we will skip number 7. Although nothing on here should be skipped in principle, you should read it yourself. He talks about the idea of pluralistic aspects of halacha, of different tiers to halacha, different factors that define. And maybe just before you turn around, let's just read the first paragraph. I'm sorry. He says, halacha as a normative order can never be suspended by external pressures, meaning you can't just pressure a poitek, nudge them enough until they say, okay. That's not how it works. Nevertheless, a specific halacha may be flexibly applied. there may be different ways to look at it, and in a sense superseded by the internal dynamics of the halakhic system proper. And in this, two distinct or be related ways. The first entails a recourse to a phalanx of factors. These are different factors that all apply to psak, of social and human and social import, which affect the decision as acknowledged halakhic elements. These are all elements in the psak, such as, at the apex stands, pikuach nefesh, other factors also, he says, financial hardship, social harmony, human dignity, sensitivity, etc., etc. He says, but, he says, while the modus operandi concerning these factors, the measure of a posik's awareness, how they are defined and how liberally applied, may be of crucial practical significance, they do not constitute philosophically the heart of the problem. Keep your head holding here. Meaning, all these issues of, well, how does kavod habrius and pikuach nefesh and financial hardship shout, that's not what we're really talking about, because that's all psak. That all you work out in the Bet Midrash, that if there's kavod habrius meaning human dignity, overrides this. And if there's shasat chag brings in this opinion, that's all theoretical. That's good. But that's not yet psika. He goes on to say, for their inclusion in the halakhic equation means that even on a formal and technical level, two apparently identical situations are not identical at all. Our primary root of concern is with the second root. The latitude allowed to a posik for differential decisions, even where all things are indeed formally and technically equal. Meaning I can have exactly the same shaila coming from Joy and coming from Miriam Chama, and it's exactly the same shaila, exactly the same situation, exactly the same posik, it's quite the exact, and yet there's a need to apply the psak differently with Miriam Chama and differently with Joy. So that, how does the Rav do that? Where does that really come from? Have a look over the page. Let's have a look now. Please read number 8. Who's reading number 8? Yes, Elisheva. Preceded or rejected, meaning we said this last time, the opinions are still out there, but they're just not applicable in most circumstances. Carry on. Exigent. What's exigent mean? Exigent. Difficult or pressing or needy circumstances. Meaning, I sometimes can turn around and say, even though we have reached a psak, in these circumstances, I need to pretend that we haven't reached a psak and reopen the general position of psak, find something else, because that's what Joy needs in these circumstances. Sorry to speak on you, but you're right in front of me. Meaning, sometimes, even when you think you've got to a psak, the exact shaila may require you to undo and reformulate that. Just shut the door, please, Annie, behind you. Carry on. Okay, yes, we did that last time. Let's carry on. This license.
This license raises an obvious question. How livery and vacuum be exercised? From how far back can discarded shittat be extracted?
Meaning, where? How far can we go back for minority opinions? Where? What is legitimate? Which views carry on? Do we ever say that a view in the postgame is just wrong? It's a mistake. It's wrong. We can't follow it. Is there such a thing? Or do we all say, like, you know, elu ve'elu divrei elokim chayim applies to everything? Carry on. Now, carry on the next paragraph. This goes back to Rav Soloveitchik that we saw at the beginning.
It is sometimes thought that the Rav of the post is the first. To the best of my knowledge, this assumption is primarily based upon a page drawn from the
Madodeich Midod, which is not what we saw, but it's similar.
In which he emphatically rejects the notion that the
psychosocial
elements are factored into the halakhic process and affected
Meaning you might read Rav Soloveitchik and say, well, Rav Soloveitchik believes in a totally objective matrix which has no basis in social, psychological realities. That sounds like what he said. He said, it's not true. It's not really what the Rav said. Carry on. Meaning the Rav does make some pretty sharp and bold comments on this. Absolutely right. Don't forget, this is the Rav's son-in-law, Rav Aaron. So he knew him as well as any person on the planet. Tenuously. What does tenuous mean? Precarious, shaky. So it's very carefully, precariously balanced passage. It's really talking about psak, not stika. Carry on. Meaning, if I feel sorry for you because you're in a difficult circumstance, that can't influence, the Rav saying is that can't influence the psak. But it, in psika, it can have a play. I had an interesting situation recently. I told the girls over Shabbos. I had a shaya that came from a girl who never asked me a shaya before. And I'm pretty sure that she asked me the shaya because she had a feel for which way I'd go on it. She was a girl that I taught in another seminary once or twice. She had one or two days Yontef Shaila. And again, I can't guarantee this, but I'm pretty sure that she felt that if she asked the more Haredi rabbis that teach in the seminary, they'd tell her to keep 2 days, but if she asked me, I might not. But maybe I'm wrong. Anyway, she asked me the Shaila, she put it to me, and I told her that I said she had to keep 2 days Yontef. And she sounded a little bit sort of surprised on the end of the phone and whatever, but she said fine. Anyway, I felt very guilty about this afterwards and was not sure whether I'd done the right thing. I mean, I thought I'd done the right thing halachically, but I felt a real sense of, like, this girl asked the shaila and I have to get the right answer. I actually decided to call my Rav in London and spend about 15 minutes on the phone with him going through the shaila, seeing if this is the way that he would analyze it. And Baruch Hashem, he analyzed exactly the way I analyzed it. He came to exactly the same psak, which I was trying to replicate because that's my Mesorah in psak, and I was happy then that I did the right thing. But commiseration or sensitivity, you feel that. You don't want to tell people no if the answer doesn't have to be no. Why would you want to do that? There's an idea of the post-sec, you should always be hard on yourself and lenient on other people. Machmir on yourself and makel on other people. Not makel on yourself and machmir on other people. Post-sec's going to try to give people the ability to do what they need to do, but that can't be part of the halachic process proper. Look at number 9. These are imminent questions to be honestly and conscientiously confronted. Surely we have no right to demand of a post-sec, almost as a matter of moral and personal right, the most comforting answer. You know, you can't make me feel that guilty when you ask me, Shilas, that you need to be able to do this or that. There has to be some objective light. The notion that, quote, where there is a rabbinic will, there is a halakhic way. I mentioned that before, right?
Yeah.
Which both insults Gedolei Torah, it makes it look as though with people as being difficult, collectively, and in its insouciance. What's insouciant? It means, bless you, it means it's ignorance, it just doesn't know, it's just amaratzus. Insouciant view of the totality of halacha verges on the blasphemous, and you'd be surprised how many people say this. They really take the view out there, a lot of people who should know better, that basically the rabbis have a big box of candies that he keeps to himself, and he only hands them out if you really ask nicely or bother him a lot. And if you nudge, eventually he'll throw out a candy and then say, but the rest, no. Meaning, if I really bother the rabbi, he'll change the mechitza a little bit. And then I'll work on him more, and then I'll work on him more. And eventually, we'll get a situation that we want here. That's not how it works. That's not right, the idea that rabbis are just making life difficult. What we do expect of a posek is that he'll walk the extra mile. Whether it's for him, wherever for him it may be, harnessing knowledge and imagination in an attempt to abide by his responsibility, both to the Torah and to his anguished fellows. I have to feel for you, whose pangs he has internalized. The posek should feel a sense of personal achrayut when somebody comes and asks him a question. For insensitive psika is not only lamentable apathy or poor public solace, it's bad halacha. If the posek doesn't really feel the pain of the person who's asking. The Rav was fond of quoting the Chofetz Chaim to the effect that when interruption of Kriya Shema were enabled, Mipnei HaKovod was not permissible but mandatory. What's this talking about? Sometimes when you're in the middle of davening, there are certain situations where you're allowed to interrupt in davening Mipnei HaKavod. Meaning, if someone asks you a question, you can't not respond. Why not? Because it's downright rude, and it's not appropriate. He was fond of saying, says the Rav, he said, the Rav was fond of saying that where you're allowed to interrupt and play a comment, it's not that you're allowed to, it's that you have to. It's wrong not to. This is what they said at the Hesped, when they said at Rav Aaron's Hesped that he never gave a heter. Remember we talked about this? Did we talk about this? Someone else, he remember that they said that one of the things they said at his Hesped is he never gave a heter. What does that mean, he never gave a heter? Right, it's not that he never said anything lenient. He gave many lenient psak halacha. But when he said, you can do this, it wasn't that, oh, alright, I mean, you could always get away with that. It was that, if this is the thing that you can do, this is the thing that you should do. This is the right thing to do. This is not just a loophole. Hate that word, loophole. This is not just technically, hate that word almost as much, okay? If it's allowed, then it's the right thing to do. And if you don't rely on this heter, then it may be the wrong thing to do. So you never get that heter as such, as an allowance, a dispensation. If it's allowed, it's the correct thing to do. Look what he says in the next paragraph.
But there is a concept of both the chetchila and b'di'evet.
Okay, but when you have a b'di'evet, now that it's a b'di'evet situation, this exactly is what is the correct thing to do. Okay. It's not that. I suppose you can get away with second best. This is the correct halakhic solution. Yes?
Can I ask a question?
Please do.
Is it true that the halakhas of being allowed to talk during davening to answer questions of Kavod Abriya come from Jesus?
No, that's not true.
It's like Jesus came to his rabbi and he asked him a question, and the rabbi was in the middle of Shema, and he like told him to wait, he didn't answer the question, and he got so offended, he's like, the rabbi doesn't care about people, and he made Christianity.
Okay. That's an interesting question. There is a medrash like that. The Rav Shul ben Parachia, he was in the middle of Kriya Shema and he pushed him away and he took it the wrong way, etc. Yeah, the comments about Jesus, not all over the Gemara. There are a very few references which were taken out by the censor and they are not present in our current Gemara. But there are like a dozen or so, you know, places where he talks about it. That's an interesting question, Joy, as to what extent when Chazal said you can answer them, they're covered. Like, it's always an interesting question when Chazal create halacha in different ways, Drabonon or make droshes, what's motivating them? And we don't know the answer to that question. Why were they, unless they say specifically, sometimes they say we made this gazer because such and such and such a thing happened. For example, there was a situation where there was a stampede on Shabbos and people were trampled and killed in the stampede. And the reason they were killed is because people were wearing these sandals with metal studs, with like cleats on the bottom. So they made a gezeirah, you're not allowed to wear those on Shabbos. Okay, so that's a clear thing. This happened, so they made a gezeirah. Because the mitzvah happened on Shabbos, that's when people gather in great numbers, etc. They made those on Shabbos. Fine. But usually we don't have that. Like when Chazal say you can interrupt in Kriya Shema if they are covered, like where's that from? Is that just a svara that they got from the nature of Christ? Is that because of a maisa that happened? That I don't know. It's a good question. When Chazal made the drosha that women are exempt from positive daim bar mitzvahs, what drove that drosha?
We don't know.
We don't know. It's a drosha min haTorah. They understand that. Did it come from Sinai? So we said Rambam says the drosha don't come from Sinai on the whole. But we can't get back into the, and the Rav would say we don't need to because it has an objective factor. Let's just go on a little bit to something else. You need to read all those yourself, and the ones we haven't seen, you need to make sure you have seen. What is the role of Chiddush in Halacha? So let's look at a few important things. Bless you. Rabbi Lezer ben Hurkanus is compared in the Gemara and Avos, in the Mishnah Avos, to a boar. What's a boar? Not a well, that's a be'er. A pit of water, it's a cistern, a water cistern, a bore, sid, what's sid? Sid. Sid means plastered. It's a plastered well. She'enu ma'abed tipa. It doesn't lose a drop. Meaning whatever you put into Rebbe Lezer ben Hurkanus, there is no leakage. It's there. He has encyclopedic knowledge of everything. Whereas Rebbe Elazar ben Arach is compared to a Ma'ayan Mitgaber. What's a Ma'ayan? A spring. What's Mitgaber?
Strengthening.
What is the essence of a spring?
It's always new.
It's always new water. You're never looking at the bore is the most the opposite to the Ma'ayan. The bore is there, which is just stagnant water, which never loses a drop, and not stagnant in a negative sense, but still water. Whereas the Ma'ayan is called, which is the better of the two? So you saw the Pirkei Avos. It says that one tzad says that Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus outweighs everything, meaning the greatest quality you can have. Even if all of Chazal were on one side of the scales, and Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus, this boar seed, was on the other, then he would outweigh the others. And yet the second opinion says no. Comes on and says, Abba Shaul says no. This is two different statements in the name of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. I mean, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had many talmidim. What did he consider to be the greatest midah of the talmidim? So one shita says, Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus, the bor sid that never loses a drop. And another said, no, even if you stood all of the chachamim plus Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus on one side, but put Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, the ever flowing well, on the other side, then he would be the one that is outweighs the other. So what's going on here? What's going on here is as an analysis of what really is the most critical factor in Jewish Torah thought. Is it retention and conserving what we have, or is it generating new? This is a fascinating idea. We see Rebbe Elazar throughout is always compared to a much more conservative psak, much a Svet Shammai type psak, and other people differently. Rabbi Yeshua is much more mechudash, etc. Look at number 16. Rav Yosef says, Rav Yosef is Sinai. It's like Har Sinai. Rashi says, Shahaya Boki Bebrisas Harbe. He knew incredible amounts. But Rava, was Oike Harim. What's Oike Harim? Smasher of mountains. Mountain smasher. What does it mean? It sounds like some kind of Havdil, I don't know, Norse god or something like that. Rava was the mountain smasher. What's a mountain smasher? He could take the principles of halacha, smash them together, and crumble them down and reformulate them. And which is better? And this is part of the question that's, you know, throughout history. Is it better that someone should be a machadish, should be coming up with chiddush, should be a mountain smasher coming up with ideas, or is it that we should be, you know, not losing a drop of what we have, of conserving the halacha that we have, of maintaining a tradition, a masorah, etc.? And there's never been a straightforward answer to this question. There's a dialectic going on here between Oike Harim and Sinai in every generation. We talked about in the Netziv, Eish Dat, that there are some generations of Eish where we burn everything up and reformulate it, and some generations of Dat where we conserve, where we pass down. Just one second, I only have 5 minutes and I don't want to keep you later than I need to. But Chiddush has always been something which is critical. Where does Chiddush come from? So I brought you a few sources here. Just look on page 5 for a second. Rav Herschel Schechter has a very, very important piece here in number 18. Look what he says. Judaism allows for chiddush, innovation, but not for shinui. What is shinui? Change in an artificial sense. Now, how do you know when it's chiddush, and how do you know when it's shinui? So he says, Judaism is not frozen. Rules that are more rigid must also respond to changed circumstances. Someone committed to Masorah must inquire of his Mevi Muvak to learn when and how to change practices, whilst remaining within traditional attitudes and patterns of behavior. So how we have to change certain things. And he says, just as science progresses, so too halacha advances. There is no day in which God doesn't innovate a halacha in the heavenly court. That's a midrash. And he brings other midrashim as well. The Rav, Rav Soloveitchik, would often say that Judaism allows for chiddush, innovation, but not for shinui, change. Not every chiddush is acceptable, he says. Tosfos known a contradiction between two Talmudic passages. The Gemara says one should learn Torah even Shelo Lishma, because from Shelo Lishma comes Lishma. And then the Gemara in Bracha says someone who learns Torah Shelo Lishma, it's better he'd never been born. So which is it? Is it good or is it bad to learn Torah Shelo Lishma? So the Netziv resolves the contradiction by saying, look, If you're learning existing Torah, meaning you're not machadesh, but you do it shaloi lishma, so that's okay. Because how much damage can you do? One day you'll do lishma. But if you're being machadesh, creating new things, that has to have proper motivation. And we see this in a number of places. Rav Yaakov Yechiel Weinberg, the Sri Deish, when he's talking about bat mitzvah, he says at the end of the day, if you want to do something new that no one's ever done before, then motivation is a critical factor. What's motivating? What's driving you? How do I know it's not shinui? Because if the motivation is wrong, it's not chiddush, it's shinui. I'm changing things that should be kept the same, as opposed to generating chiddush. And this line is a very fine line to draw. I brought you in 1920 interesting perspectives on chiddush and shinui as well. And number 21, which is a must. You must read number 21. I'm not going to read the whole thing now. But Rav Soloveitchik spells out in more detail what we started with. This idea, which sounded at the beginning of Rav Soloveitchik saying that nothing can change, everything is objective, everything is fixed in a halakhic ontology. He says, no, that's really not the case. He talks about the idea of Torah scholars producing new ideas. Have a look in the middle of the first left-hand side. When innovation is weakened, the halacha becomes sterile. Those who disparage us say that halacha has become fossilized, God forbid, that it contains no creative activity. These people have never studied a page of Talmud. They believe Rabbeinu Tam didn't introduce new ideas, or Maimonides, or Nachmanides, or the Gaon of Vilna, or Chaim of Brisk. How ludicrous that accusation is. Of course they did new things all the time. The aforementioned Rishonim and Achronim created new worlds that are breathtaking in their beauty and sublimity. They are among the greater innovators in halachic thoughts. Anyone who is acquainted with halachic methodology, etc., must admit that the sweep and scope of its ideal are creative, etc., etc. But then he says, that in the second line, in the second column, in the right-hand side, says, but at the end of the day, how do we know that our innovation is correct and secure? And he goes in great details to say that. Therefore, basically, trying to understand this interface between Masorah and Chiddush is really important. Understanding the difference between Psak, which is based in an analytical form, and Psika, which is one of the places that sort of Chiddush on an individual level happens, is also very critical. And these are very complex ideas, and most people you meet out there, most Shabbat table conversations you have with most people, do not take into account the complexity of the situation. They're often very, visceral, or people make statements very clearly without having really understood that these things are deeply subtle. Therefore, all I'm trying to do here, the class, if you like, can't do justice to it, but I'm trying to introduce you to some of the sources which talk about these. You really need to go away and learn them properly. They deserve further study between you, Chavrusa, and next year when you're in, wherever you are, Stern, Shurut Lami, wherever you are, you sit down and learn. These things are things that people talk about a lot, and most people don't always know what they're talking about. And none of us always know what we're talking about, but we have to do our best. All right.